Hey, what's going on? It's Bill Burr, and this is a very special edition of the Monday Morning Podcast. You know, every once in a while here on the podcast, rather than listening to my psycho ramblings and my jam jams as I lay on my bed, every once in a while I'll have a guest on of high esteem, and this episode is of no exception. This is a man I've done a lot of radio with, but I've never had as a guest. Please welcome the one, the only, the legendary, from New Jersey, Mr. Jimmy Norton.
Thank you, Bill.
What's going on?
It's funny. It's like, I know you're such a solo guy when you do your podcast. I almost felt like when I texted you to do it, I almost felt like, you were the hardest one for me to text. I know you longer than I know any of them.
Right.
And it was you were the hardest one because I'm like, Bill does it by himself. I didn't want to put him on the spot. But you said you've had some guests.
No, I've had greats. I had Jay Moore. I've had.
Oh, okay.
I've had Dave Koechter. I've had Michael Rappaport was great. Just the whole sports thing. That guy's like a total like hoop head. And all,
is he really?
Yeah, fuck Boston and all that. So we had a great going back and forth. And, of course, he trashed me for the Giants beating the Patriots. So I try to get guests that I'm friends with because I'm not the greatest interviewer.
Right.
And so I definitely, you know, someone that I've done a bunch of radio with. Now watch, are we feeling the tension that it's all going to go off the rails?
No, it's funny. It's one of those things, though. Whenever you're with a friend or whenever you're interviewing or talking to somebody that you know as well as we know each other, it's all you almost feel self-conscious. Like, oh, no, they're going to think I'm putting on my performer hat or my interviewer hat or my radio guy hat. It's like, oh.
Jim, tell us, how did you get your start?
I know. And that's what comedy podcasts have turned into. Every comic asks, and Colin won't do them. He's like, I'm sick and tired of talking about the fucking process. You know, he doesn't want to hear people talk about the process, and he's right.
I'm out of stories. I kind of, like, tapered back on doing other podcasts. Not because I don't like other podcasts. I've run out of stories. I don't know how many more. Like the amount of times I tell a story, and I've probably told this one before,
yeah.
But I mean, you know, everybody's got your classic half dozen stories, unless you're like a guy like Jim Jeffries, and you just live in like a classic story, it seems, every three fucking weeks.
Yeah, an active alcoholic. If you're an active alcoholic and always have
stuff. No, he's not that.
Is he sober now?
Yeah, he's been a good boy for a couple years.
Good for Jim.
Maybe. Even if he isn't, I'm not going to say he's an active alcoholic. I just got to sit there and be like, you know, he likes having a good time, that Jim Jeffries.
Yeah, he came in one time, and he was, I think, still gone from the night before. It was quite enjoyable. I don't drink anymore, but I love a guy who's drunk, like on the air. It's awful to deal with in real life, but on the air, it's
put a microphone in front of him. It's great radio.
God, they're great. He brought in, who's that big Irish comedian, Andrew something? He's one of the biggest ones. He does arenas in Ireland.
Oh, okay.
He came in on St. Paddy's Day, and he was fucking loaded.
Not Tommy Turnin.
No. We've had him, too. But
okay.
I think he was this sober. This guy, I think, is bigger than Tommy. And he was just so drunk and obnoxious. It was just funny to watch this guy who, in his home country, he's like Kevin Hart.
Right.
And just loaded and fucking 7 o'clock in the morning, blathering, making no sense. I'm like, it doesn't matter who you are. Thank God I don't drink anymore.
No, they don't fuck around over there. Like, it is a... it's a whole other – but, I mean, there's definitely – it's not like everybody over there is a drunk.
Right.
But, like, there isn't like that I'm saying this as a tourist. I just didn't see the level of concern where everybody's so worried about everybody over here. Like, do you think he has a – I'm really concerned about so-and-so. Like, I didn't feel that vibe over there. It was more like if you felt you had a problem – maybe you tried to go to an – I don't know if they have AA over there. Is that worldwide?
Sure.
Has that spread?
Yeah, it's made it everywhere. Russia has it. From what
no, it doesn't. Does it?
Oh, yeah. Everywhere has it. Yeah, that's what I've been told.
Are there YouTube clips of just like people saying it in all different languages?
You know, that's a good question. I've never looked. From what I understand, the program is anonymous, so people don't state their affiliation with it publicly.
Just right. You wouldn't film it.
They probably wouldn't allow that. Yeah, they'd probably frown on some guy with
a fucking moron.
No, how would you know?
I mean, film the anonymous meeting?
Dude, this is
the level. This is the level of intellect that you're going to get on this. So fucking settle in.
There's nothing wrong with that. It's one of those things where everything's online anyway.
I mean,
everything is video. The fact that the fucking first tower getting hit, there's a clip of that.
Hey, I don't have a windscreen on that, so you're popping on your peas a little bit. So that's my fault. Sorry.
No,
I'm down to my last one.
5 days a week for 10 years, and I don't know not to go into a fucking microphone. I'm a true idiot. But the fact that – that's why Opie, by the way, says but and not put. He'll say, did you put that down? Like there's certain words he says P is B because he –
He went to broadcasting school. Did he? That sounds like such a broadcasting school
was
thing.
In college? No, maybe in college he learned. I think he learned in college actually, but he went from communications. But the fact that there is footage of the first tower getting hit, like that plane going in. And, you know, back then everyone didn't have the cell phones or the cameras. It's a miracle. Like, so it's not surprising that people think that things are going to be filmed. I don't know why I'm on this tangent, but it's not surprising to me.
Okay. I'm glad that was a tangent because I was like trying to adjust the level there as you adjust the microphone away from me. I was like, oh my God, he's talking about 9/11. Where the hell did we go?
Oh,
there?
Yeah, just for a second. Just, okay. I just thought of like a weird thing to be on film.
Just as a color.
Yeah, just a little something. Just, a little subtlety. Just to bring us back to how lucky we are, Bill. You know, how awkward would it be if I just mentioned 9/11 and started blubbering? Or anything worse than somebody cries like way too long after 9/11?
Oh, by the way, we're sitting in Jim's fucking fabulous hotel room, so that would really be fucking uncomfortable.
Just creepy, yeah.
As long as the mics are on and I feel there's an audience, even though I can't see them,
yeah.
It wouldn't be that bad. But if we were just here by ourselves, which fucking takes me back to a moment.
Cleveland?
I was in a hotel room pissed and you fucking knocked on the door and talked me off the fucking ledge. It was the gig after the Philly gig where I was like, I knew that they were going to boo me again just to boo me. Rather than Philly, they booed me because they didn't like me. And then by the time the fucking Cleveland gig, you guys gave me so many props that the crowd wanted to see it again.
Yeah.
So I was asking somebody there, hey, just put me on early. Give me a chance. Just give me a chance. Everybody's like, yeah, don't worry. And then I was in the exact same spot. I go out there and I just walk out. I'm on for 2 seconds. They just start booing me. Just to boo me, and I was like, look, I'm not going to pretend to get mad because you guys are pretending to boo me, and it didn't go anywhere. And I got off stage, and I was fucking livid. I remember me and Jeff Will still laugh about it because Jeff was like, no, I'm sorry. I was like, fuck you. Fuck this venue. Fuck this state. Fuck everything. And I left. I think I threw a water bottle.
Yeah, you were very unhappy.
I was not happy. And because me, I catastrophize in my head, so I was like going, oh, my God, I've become the boo-em guy, and I'm going to go everywhere I go. I kind of forgot because I had been on the virus tour long enough that, to me, a normal show was fucking 10,000 people.
Right.
And I wasn't thinking, like, my next gig after that tour was at the Punchline. It's like a cozy 200 people, and I can see everyone, you know. And so if anybody fucked with me, I could get them. And so I go back to the fucking hotel room. Ready to quit the business, and I hear a knock on the door, and you came walking in and fucking talked me off the ledge.
I remember that. I don't even remember what we spoke about. I just remember you were very upset, and I knew why, and you were like, they fucking – and I was like, dude, they did it because they were trying to recapture a moment that they wanted to be a part of something that was very amazing to them as opposed to they hated you. You know what I mean?
I was convinced everyone was out to get me. The crowd, the show – Live Nation, everybody.
Still convinced they're out to fuck me. I couldn't get on the Oddball Tour this year. I can't get on the Oddball Tour, and they're doing fucking the Tweeter Center and
you played half
PNC.
Those places.
What's that?
You've played half of those places.
Yeah, and I can't get on the – I couldn't get a fucking set on the Oddball.
Ah, whatever. They'll have it next year. Yeah, you know how this shit is. Guys like you and me, we always got to go the extra fucking whatever it is. It was always – remember that when they were doing the half hours – yeah. On Comedy Central or the whatever the fuck there was. It was always the guy with the silly hat, the person with the catchphrase, the hot chick, the fat guy, you know, the black guy who doesn't scare white people. They had to get through all of those. And then they also had to get the veterans that they fucked over on the last group of half hours. They have to get rid of all of those fucking guys. And then it was always us afterwards.
I never did one for Comedy Central. I was so resentful over being passed over. I was like Fredo. I just was like, fuck these guys. I'm not going to do it. And then I waited for HBO.
I'm funny too.
Yeah.
Not like everybody says.
Yeah, well, that's the way Doug wanted it. The way I wanted it. Yeah. So I want to hold out for HBO. And we finally did them for HBO. And they were supposed to do four. And they were going to be really these special half hours. And they wound up doing 10 of them. And, you know, I'm happy we did it.
But yeah.
I'm glad I held out for HBO.
Yeah, you did the same year that I did it.
Well, it was
taped with Patrice. You taped with Kevin.
That's
Brennan,
right?
I still remember that. And then Louis C.K.
Yep.
Here's the thing. One time, you know, because I'm obsessed with trying to own everything I did, you know, I tried to buy my half hour back from HBO, but they wanted me to buy the whole – I had to buy the whole fucking series. I had to buy, like, all 10 of them.
How much
like,
they want?
Oh, Jesus. It was, like, you know, in the millions. So it was just – I mean, I was looking at, like, well, it cost me $130 to shoot an hour, so I ought to be able to offer them 65, fucking yeah. 65. And they were like, no, you have to buy the whole season and, like, you know, fucking – I don't know, some – the thing to throw money at the Sopranos or something to get it. But I wish I had the money because – but nowadays everyone just steals everything anyway, so it's probably dumb. But when I was looking back at that, I'm like, that series is fucking insane.
Yeah.
That's you, Patrice O'Neill, rest his soul, is the fucking greatest I ever saw. Louis, Earthquake.
That's right. Flight of the Conchords was one.
Flight of the Conchords was one. That's right. I forgot they were on it.
They wanted me to do it with those guys, and I didn't want to.
I did one, and I was just like, you know. I think once What's-His-Face bought Delirious off of him, they were shy. They got a little gun shy.
Oh, he owns it now, Murphy. I didn't know that.
Mm-mm. No, What's-His-Face. Coming up next, Comics Unleashed, that guy.
Oh, Byron Allen owns
Byron Allen bought
that motherfucker.
Delirious. HBO showed that fucking thing, and then they just, when we were kids, teenagers, and they just never showed it again. They had it in their library, and somehow Byron Allen went in there and bought it off of them.
How much?
I don't know what he paid for it, like a couple $1 million, and right before the whole DVD thing died, he put it out at like 15, 20 a whack, and he sold like 4 million of them or something.
Wow. Yeah. He's a genius.
He's
that
a
guy.
Fucking, he is. And a lot of people don't really, I don't like talking about people's money, but this fucking guy, it's like this guy, he has like 3/4 Oprah money and people don't even know.
Yeah.
They just look at him like he's one of those guys, like, you know, like how Seinfeld sees a show where everybody else sees just hanging out.
Right.
He's one of those guys. Like I saw Seinfeld on The Daily Show the other day talking to Jon Stewart, and they were joking how he was saying how he did TV right, how he just did it. Did it once, it lives forever. And Jon Stewart, when he does an episode of The Daily Show, it's all topical. So no one's going to buy the box set of The fucking Daily Show. And I'm taking the long way around here. So he was talking about the new TV show he's doing on the net, which is fucking comedians in cars getting coffee. And he said, which is what I would be doing anyway.
Right.
So Byron Allen was a guy, took those press junkets. When you were just like, what was it like to work with Steven Spielberg? Talk about Mel Gibson, blah, 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 all that. He actually saw a show. And then that's where he came up with that coming up next thing. It was just the fucking press junkets.
I know what coming up next is.
That's, he would say, coming up next, Jim Norton talking about the Vice show that he's on and blah, blah, blah. And he turned that into a fucking TV show. That Comics Unleashed is genius.
It's literally just, and it's the worst setups of all time. It's just do your act for 3 minutes in a clip.
But it's fucking genius. And he produces the whole thing. He owns the whole fucking – the guy is a genius. Like, he's like a hero of mine as far as, like, the way he does, like, this business.
Yeah.
He's basically – for people – if I'm – this is too going too quick here. He basically – that show, if you don't watch it, it's just Byron Allen sitting there with 3 or 4 other comics. He already knows what your bits are.
Oh, yeah.
So you've already written the whole fucking show for him, and all he does is just say your setup. Like, so, Jim, have you ever lived in a fucking building in New York? And then you're like, as a matter of fact, I have.
And the other comics on that drive, because nobody's calling each other out. Like, they're all, like, just participating. Like, it is really a good time we're having. Like, how can 3 comedians sit there and listen to a guy do a bit off that setup and not want to fucking attack him?
Well, like, they can't do that because then they get sued by Tough Crowd.
Yeah, you know what? I guess that's what made Tough Crowd fun.
Tough Crowd was fucking awesome. That has such a... such a cult following. Do you know people, they ask me like just as much for just a long a time. Like when's Chappelle's show coming back? When's Tough Crowd coming back? Those two shows had like these diehard fans. And I still don't, I don't understand. What about Colin? Huh? Getting that, he got his own show and he gave every comedian in New York a TV credit.
Yeah.
Just about. Like I was trying to. I remember towards the last season of that, I was trying to think of somebody who hadn't been on it. He got everybody on that show.
I think he did. Yeah, it was Bobby. Bobby wasn't a regular on it, but Bobby was on it a couple of times.
Bobby Kelly?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he was on it quite a bit.
No, I don't think he was. I could be wrong about that. Maybe I'm thinking Opie and Anthony because he didn't do Opie and Anthony on NEW. He didn't do that till we were on Satellite. So maybe he was on Tough Crowd more than I thought.
Right.
But I remember him being talked about warm up for it at one point. He's like, I don't want to fucking warm up, dude. You know, man, Bobby gets. So I think that, you know, he gets a very short fuse. So I think that he was on a few times, but I don't think I ever did it with him.
Right.
He'd get mad at me, too. He got mad at me because I didn't remember that we went to Vegas. Like, I remember we went to Vegas together, but not the actual fight, and he got very angry at me. I'm like, yeah, that was Uriah Faber. He's like, fuck, dude, I know. I was fucking there with you. I'm like, oh, all right. Sorry. Forgot.
I can't make fun of anybody for having a temper, but he's another guy who he's always had to go the extra fucking 12 miles. He's just one of those guys. He does got that short thing. I remember one time I was walking down the street with him and he was talking, you know, we all just start complaining about the business. So he was complaining about the business, and he was going to help me with the computer. You know, he's great with the computer, so he was going to help me. And as we were walking, I used to live around the corner from him, and I'm thinking, well, my computer's up on the, you know, the fucking whatever, the seventh floor, and he's on the ground floor. And I'm thinking in my head, let me go up and get the computer, and we'll take it over to his house. So as he's telling, like, his, you know, fucking 20th story about this business, I said, hey, Bob, can I just go up and get that? And he just fucking snapped, and he goes, don't interrupt me, cunt! Fucking screamed it. Screamed it on 9th Avenue in, like, broad daylight. And dude, like, everybody, you know, people looking and shit, and I just looked at him like... And the old me would have taken the bait, and I would have gotten to this big fuck you fight. I don't even know if this is the new me. I just was not in, I don't know, I just wasn't in a place where I was mad or anything. Yeah. He so came out of nowhere that I just kind of looked at him, and I was like, Bob, I thought we kind of got past doing this to each other. And then he kind of laughed, and it was gone, which he's always been able to do. As much as that guy flips the fuck out, he's able to bring it back down and be like, all right, dude, listen, dude, I'm fucking
sorry. Yeah, he's not a grudge holder necessarily.
Yeah. So he fucking – that was like an instant Bobby classic, don't interrupt me, cunt.
Yeah, that's – what a great line.
Echoing. Yeah. I just like how he said it like I worked for him. Like I felt like he should have been behind some big walnut desk. Well, is it? Maybe we could do this. Don't interrupt me, cunt. I'm talking because you fucked this up. You know?
That makes me so happy. That makes me so happy. That's a fucking Bobby scream, and I'm really happy that that happened to somebody other than me.
He's
a frightening guy when he fucking yells. I hate to admit it, but Bobby's a fucking maniac. He does scare me.
I would call him a maniac, but that's the old pot and kettle there. I'm out of my fucking mind, dude. Like when I'm out here, I literally had to make a rule about just relaxing when I drive. And one thing that I helped is very therapeutic for me is letting people go.
Right.
If you're really like, I get so frustrated with the quality of the driving out here, the inability to fucking make turns at a decent speed. And dude, when they go buy shit out here, the second they pass it, they don't even remember it. There's no fucking clue as to what's behind you. Like, you know what they do here out here that fucking drives me nuts? You'll be sitting behind some guy at a red light, you know, and you're up on his bumper, you know, like you're supposed to be, nothing crazy. And as the light turns green, he then puts his left fucking directional on.
It's absolute enraging, and it's self-centered, and yeah, it's I'm with you.
Is it wrong that I fantasize about pushing him into traffic?
No, it's wrong that you don't have the moral courage to do it. I think that's totally right. And whenever you hear about someone getting shot and killed for road rage, everyone first goes, oh my God, that maniac that shot that person. And I, honest to God, the first thing I think is, I'm glad. Like, and until I find out the guy with the gun was the dick.
Right.
Who fucked up first.
I love that you have to find out that the guy with the gun was a dick.
I know. To find out that
until I find out the guy with the gun overreacted a little.
But it's just, there's something about, because people are so self-centered and narcissistic when they drive. It's a reflection of who they really are. So that's why we take it so fucking personally, man. Like, you let people go. If the guy, if a guy doesn't wave thank you to me, that's
they don't do that out
cardinal
here.
Sin.
They don't do that out here. And I go from like being this fucking Mother Teresa person, I turn into the devil. It starts, I try to stay calm. It starts with a couple of reallys in my car. I just go, really? 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 You're not going to fuck these fucking people out here? I don't know what the fuck I ever moved down here for. I end up turning into that just because some douche. Dude, you see the look on their face. They're like, please, please, please let me go. And you go to let them go and you think, like, oh, hey, right. Thumbs up, something, nothing. They immediately are just back into their own I don't know. I find sometimes I wave at people out here and they look at me like weird. Like, what, do you know me? Like, maybe, you know, I did move 2,500 miles away from where I learned, you know, societal rules. So maybe – but, you know, you just think if, you know – you're waving to another white guy. I mean, we're pretty fucking generic.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of depth to the culture here.
Yeah, there's no gang signs in our way. I can see black guys get a little freaked out watching which way your fingers are turning. Well, plus East Coast, though, is so aggressive. And I hate to do like an LA thing. But out here, maybe that courtesy, like, you know, in Boston or New York, if someone lets you cut in, it's like, hey, motherfucker, I did you a courtesy. And you're like, hey, thank you for the courtesy.
Yeah, you're a good shit, dude.
You're welcome. But here, it's like, well, that was just expected because they might do that for each other more out here. And oh, so it's not right. A big deal. That's the only way I can think of. I was on the Pennsylvania Turnpike one time driving to a gig, and I know I'm popping all over. I'm very self-conscious talking, so I want
no,
to
you're
pop
doing,
my
you're
piece.
Doing much better, but I don't have anybody to help us out with this.
Okay. I was driving to a gig, and a guy cut into my lane. I was doing about 70. It was raining, and he had a trailer. It was a
which
nightmare.
Is normal.
And I'm like,
I'm hydroplaning, you know.
Yeah, it was a rear-wheel drive, too, with my Mustang. Real hunk of shit fucking hydroplaning car. Good call. And I'm driving, and this guy's coming into my lane. And I immediately, your mind, when you think you're going to die, goes very quickly. And I'm like, okay, you got to slam on the brakes. You're going to have an accident. Hit the wall. Like, it try to.
Yeah, that's smart. Yeah, slow yourself down, sideswipe it.
Hit the wall. So I jam on the brake. I hit the horn, and he veers out, and we don't have the accident. So then I'm not afraid. I'm in a rage at this fucking guy.
Right.
And I pull up next to him, and it's a fat black dude, like, you know, a family mopey guy. And I'm ready to really, you know.
It's whatever. Cleveland from Family Guy.
Actually, yes. William Stevenson, for those of you that go to the comedy store. And he looks at me, and he gives me the, like, oops, I fucked up wave. Like, oops, sorry. And he gives me that. And every bit of anger drained.
You can't, because he just owned up to it.
I'm sorry.
And sorry. Yeah.
I waved back. No problem. Yeah. That was it. In a second, my rage was gone.
You know what's funny? I sometimes, when somebody acts on the rage, even though I know it's wrong, I sort of live through the fucking ecstasy that must be. Like, do you remember when Russell Crowe threw the phone
yes.
at the guy? I just can't imagine, like, when you're in a hotel and you're not getting the customer service you want on whatever it is, that the fact that you actually take the machine that they won't help you with and fucking hurt somebody, the person who's not helping you, you fucking hurt him with it.
Yeah.
Completely wrong thing to do. But I can't imagine. I always was wondering, like, when he's letting that phone go, just fucking all that rage going at him. I think it was good for him. It was bad for the guy behind the
Behind
the counter was bad.
Well, two people learned a lesson that day. Russell Crowe learned not to do it. The other guy probably learned better fucking customer service yeah. next time. Because I remember when that happened. I was in the Greenwich Hotel, which De Niro owns. And I remember
oh, my God. That's a really nice place.
It's beautiful.
Like he would stay at a dive. What a stupid comment.
But I remember thinking the satisfaction it must have felt when the phone hit the guy. Like how good that must have felt to throw that phone at that motherfucker. And again, he got in big trouble for that. But yeah, that was a story that I
do
think.
Do you know how mad you are? You're pulling the wires out of the wall, and that voice is still not going, okay, what are you doing, dude? What are you doing? And then you wrap it up. You leave your hotel. You're walking down the hall. You leave your room. You get into the fucking elevator, and your brain's still going, yeah, throw it at him. Yeah, throw it at him.
Is that what happened?
Well, I mean, he went downstairs to the front. I mean, I don't
know. I was assuming you picked the phone up off the desk and just threw it at him.
Oh, I thought he was upstairs in his room.
Maybe he was, but I thought that I thought he just picked the phone up and threw it at the guy.
That makes way more sense.
But if I find out that he actually wrapped the cord and took the phone from downstairs, that makes me love him more. I loved him just for picking it up.
I probably fucked it up. I fuck up everything. I don't know. Do you know the other day I actually called the periodic chart? I called it the periodical.
But that's understandable. I mean, one's
I was on
magazine.
Breaking Bad. There's no excuse. It's like you're on a Western and you call it a cowboy hat. How do you not fucking know? It shows you the amount of fucking research I did. Dude, sometimes on Twitter when you get trashed, it's just so fucking on the money. And I always read it. People are just being mean to be mean. But when they call me out for all the stupid shit, it really it makes being on Twitter worth it.
Yeah.
Because other than hyping your shows, it's usually just a bunch of people giving you shit.
Sure it is.
With half the fucking information. Pause on that. They fucking – and then it just becomes like, it just becomes like, why am I on this thing? Because it'll literally put you in a bad mood. But then every once in a while, somebody – like that guy waving, you know, in the car. It just gives you shit in the right way and it makes you fucking laugh. You retweet. They psyched you retweet them and it just – it becomes like, all right. I'm fucking cool with Twitter again.
I have a piece of criticism. Somebody bashed me one time. And I actually have it on my desktop. And I've opened it a few times and read it. It was just about like, you know, I used to love Jim. But the guy made some valid points as to what I do wrong on the radio. And about how like – and I felt
that – like constructive criticism?
Yeah, but he was mad. But I actually felt like, this is actually coming from a guy who is a fan and who just thinks I've been quite a cunt for a while. And you know what? I read it and it just resonated with me like this guy is not wrong I mean, I don't like what he said, but I
it's very mature way of handling criticism.
But yeah, I normally it's much more like rageful. I want to find out who they are, and I get very, very angry. And this time it just got me right. I'm like, I know he's being honest.
Yeah,
and he's like, oh, I have been doing that. Ugh. It feels exposing when some stranger just notices your fucking your weaknesses and your crutches.
I've had a couple of heckles like that. Where they kind of put you in your place and you got to be like, you want to be like, what do you do for a living? That sucks. But you have to be like, I finally learned at one point. Oh, you know something? I actually learned about handling hecklers in a different way watching you. I did down at Caroline's. It finally clicked. I learned through watching you, you don't have to chop all their heads off. Sometimes they are ordering food. Sometimes they're just repeating a punchline. Like I saw, I forget what they were talking, and you just kind of said something. What'd you say? Oh, okay. And you kind of like – you actually asked them what they said. I think that's what it was, rather than just assuming that they were trashing you, saying that you sucked. Because the amount of times I kept having this reoccurring thing where someone – if anybody talked, I was convinced they were saying that I sucked. And they were making fun of how I looked or whatever. You know, this is the first 8-9 years of my career. And I would chop their heads off. And the amount of times afterwards people would come up to me at the end of shows going, I was just asking where the bathroom was, or I was actually saying I enjoyed your act and blah, 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 blah. And then I felt like I couldn't get out of it, man. I was locked in this, you know, get him kind of vibe. And then I was watching you it took me a while to learn how to do that.
Well, I had one too. It's once in a while that will happen at the Cellar, because that's such a loud, small area. Where you'll say something, you'll hear somebody talking, and I can always see if it's somebody ordering a drink, then I leave it alone, because it's a small room. But once in a while, you'll hear talking, and I've had a few people over the years go like, "What'd you say? I think you're funny. I'm enjoying you." And then I just kind of I repeat that, and I just kind of get the audience to laugh at me with it, because it's like, all right, they all know I was about to attack the person.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they all know that this was an almost heckle.
So did you always do that, or is that something?
I think I learned it in a place called Arbajon's, which was it's where I first met Ari Spears back in like 1991 when he was going. His mom would bring him to open mics, and he would do these RoboCop impressions, but he was too young to get in by himself, so his mother took him. And it was a Sheraton bar area. And
I just felt a wave of depression. I probably did that gig.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, East Brunswick, New Jersey. When did you start? What year?
I started March of 92.
Okay, yeah, so you might have. It was right around that time.
Well, I started up in Massachusetts, and then I got down to New York. I probably did my first road gig out there end of 95, beginning of 96. Okay. But I remember going out to some of those Jersey ones in those hotels.
Awful.
Yeah, they were either great or you just were driving home fucking – that's, you know, 1,000-yard stare like, oh, my, what have I done?
I remember doing one with Vinnie Brand and Bob Levy where there was a pool, I believe, in between us and the audience. I'll never forget that gig. We were on one side. It was a Holiday Inn, and it was in the pool area. And
is an obvious place for a comedy show.
Wonderful place to try your art.
Wet feet slapping by as you're fucking trying to do your jokes.
Yeah, it was really bad. I remember we were in the front, but I remember there was a pool, I think, between us and the crowd. But in that Arbajon's room, I was smashing a heckler.
Arbajon's.
And nobody was laughing in the back. And then I realized, like, oh, they can't hear what is being said.
Right.
Repeat what they say. A, it buys you another couple seconds, and nobody knows you're doing it. Right. Isn't that weird, like, how with the audience, we know we're – like, you know, someone's like, you know, you suck. You're terrible. I suck, and I'm terrible. It's like you've just bought yourself –
yeah.
And if you hit them, priceless you still get credit.
Time. Priceless time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really weird. I don't know how to explain this to people. When people are like, how did you come up with that fast? Like, I don't know. When you see a funny moment, I don't mean a written joke, but if someone slams you and you're great at fucking firing back immediately. Like Daryl Hammond said, he sees impressions as colors, like a yellow or an orange. He can't explain it. When I see like slamming something as like – it's like these weird choices you're making. They're kind of floating in front of you. Like you don't see the words.
Is
like,
that why you're so – because you got the fastest mind of anybody. When you used to sit at the table at the Cellar, dude, when you – is Patrice was the, like – would just make you fucking
– yeah.
You'd start crying when he was the best. But like as far as speed – like, I thought Patrice a lot of times he would use his laugh to drown you out. Like, he had all these different things. You would just sit there. I remember when you'd start looking at me, I was like, oh, fuck, he's looking at me. It was a different thing. Like, with Keith, I felt Keith Robinson, Keith, you could get a mitt in his face to try to throw him off. Like, Keith, stop looking at me, blah, blah, blah. And that would make him forget what he was going to say. But you never forgot. And Voss, all you had to do with Voss, I had techniques for all you guys to survive the pond. Voss, all you had to do was lay on the ropes, and eventually he would say something that bombed, and then it would come back on him. He always got bit. He would hit you one, two, three times, and then that fourth or fifth one would be so bad it bombed that everyone would then jump on him. So you never really had to get him back.
Voss would be pounding you, but he always got greedy and threw a right-hand lead.
Yeah. He'd always punch himself out.
But how do you see – when you're – whether it's a heckler or whatever, how do you – I can't explain to people how that works. Like, how do you think of a joke or a funny thing to say? It's almost like it's just like watching things float in front of you and you're grabbing them.
I look at it more like in the beginning – it was like, remember, like, I have to have these stock lines.
Right.
Hey, where'd you learn how to whisper?
Helicopter.
A helicopter factory? Yeah. Like, what is that? They're already on? Yeah. It didn't even make sense. And it always got a laugh. But it was more like I had those stock lines. And then it became, I was watching Greg Fitzsimmons, and I've told him this before on his show. I learned from Greg where Greg would just ask him, like, Greg is fucking unbelievable. He's so good at fucking with people in the crowd. I remember one time we were playing this place, the Grill 93 in, oh my God, where was it? It was up, was on Route 93.
It's Massachusetts?
Yeah, it was not Arlington. That was where Dane was from.
Springfield?
I can't remember. I began with an A. I don't remember. And
Andover, Mass?
Andover. There you go. Yeah, the Grill 93 in Andover, Mass. And these two guys showed up with matching American flag shirts. And they sat in the front row, and Greg was so good at trashing people. Like, I was either hosting or featuring, but me and the host, or me and the feature, both said to Greg, we're not going to fuck with those guys, but you have to promise us that you're going to, right at the beginning, go after them. And he goes, absolutely, absolutely. So we deliberately did not. I mean, these guys wanted to get picked on, and Greg ended up going up there, and he just started telling this story that just went all the way around the fucking bend to the point people are like, what is he talking about? And somehow he brought it around the beat. You know, I mean, that would be like, I don't know, like wearing matching American flags shirts with your friends or something. And then he just pointed at the guys and opened his mouth like David Lee Roth, you know, when he looks at the back row. And it just fucking absolutely destroyed. I saw him one time at the Kowloon. It was like Hannibal Lecter shit. He could tell by the shoes the guy was wearing. He guessed the guy's name in four guesses. He guessed his job. The table the guy was sitting at was going nuts. And it was just all – and, of course, his name was horrible. His job was horrible. Where he lived was horrible. He started – did a little vignette of their family. Like, he's unbelievable at doing stuff like that. So that's funny. When people ask me, you know, who are your influences, blah, blah, blah. You know, as much as it was the greats that you listen to, people don't understand that not only did you learn – you know, I was watching Attell, CK, and all those guys who were beyond me. But I learned watching guys that were, you know, breaking in at the same time
Our peers did. Sure, sure.
Yeah, where you're starting to – because I, a lot of times you would get yourself into the same situation that a more seasoned guy wouldn't. And I would watch you get out of it and be like, oh, I never thought to do it that way.
Right. That's how you take it and stop it before it goes off the cliff and the whole – because I realized, too, that a lot of times I would lose crowds by hitting too hard. Like, you know, a guy throws up something that deserves a four. It's almost like in
– you go right to – I hope you get AIDS.
Yeah, right to him. Yeah, like, what's that? What's that? Your fucking wife's got cancer. Like, what? Dude, but there's totally unnecessary. Like, and the crowd hates you for it. So it's like – the worst is when someone's heckling you in the front. I'll never forget this guy heckling me at Rascals. I was a new comic, but even back then I knew this guy was being a twat because he was heckling me, and it wasn't horrible shit that he was saying. But it was his eyes. Like, I knew he's the fucking – that scumbag in the office who's resentful that he's not up here getting laughs. You're like, yeah. And the audience can't see it. So I was pounding him, and I really ruined his night. And the crowd hated me for it.
Because they couldn't see what a dick he was.
But you know how, like, you know, you just know.
Oh, yeah, of course I do.
And you can always tell.
I made that mistake a zillion times.
I'll never regret doing it, though. It's like, that's 25 years ago. It's been my first year of comedy. And I still feel good that I wrecked that piece of shit's night because I knew he was coming after me.
You know, I remember I was at the Punchline in Atlanta and I had a guy like that. And all I can remember about what he looked like was he had loafers with no socks and he had fat feet. So there was like, they were bulging out the front and he kept putting his feet on the stage. So I made the joke to take him off or whatever, and is, you know, because he really, you know, had, he just was fucking annoying me. And it was just the fact that he kept putting him back. I knew that it wasn't, oh, I'm sorry, I just need to stretch my legs out. There was some sort of power things going. You're breathing into the mic there. There was like a power thing. There was like this power thing going on with him, and it literally escalated to the point that they had to kick him out. And when he stood up, he made sure he got on the stage and took like half a step towards me. And he was just, you know, this little fucking, I don't know, he probably was doing well in business, and he was used to people telling, not, you know, telling other people what to do. And but whatever, here we are. Now we're sitting here talking about the process. I want to make sure that I get to the whole reason. Why is a fancy man like yourself out here in Los Angeles? Do you got you working on something? What's going on?
Well, my thanks, Bill. That was my advice show is coming on, and you know, I just had to come out and plug it. It's hard to plug shit.
No, it isn't. That's great, dude. What? Tell me about the show.
I'm happy about it to do it. Like it's just an interview show. So I talk to, you know, I do a monologue. I mean, I feel ashamed whenever I explain things that
Why?
Are good. I don't know. It's that whatever makes me a comic is that fucking
right.
Shame thing. Colin described it as shame spirally. You know, it's hosting a talk show, and it's, I always wanted to do it. So I hosted. I did four episodes and you do a monologue, a sketch.
You're hosting a talk show?
Yeah, yeah.
That's fucking great.
Yeah, I'm happy, man. It's my first guests were Tyson and Dana White together. And it was awesome. I mean, it was like a really good interview. And I was like, wow, man, that went well.
I've never seen, and I mean this in a good way, I've never seen him give a guy like you a talk show.
They don't.
That's great. Yes. Yeah, because usually it's, you know, they're usually telling, you know, if you're doing a talk show, hey, Jim, kind of tone it down a little. So what channel is it on?
It's on vice.com. It's online, which is kind of where I wanted it.
And now can you curse and stuff?
Do whatever you want. Total content freedom.
I had total
content freedom. Bailey J is my co-host, and she's kind of like my announcer. Do you know Bailey?
Yeah.
Lovely girl. And, you know, so I think it turned out. It was Bobby's suggestion. It's like, dude, you got to get Bailey involved. And I think it's
oh,
funny.
Bailey J, the okay. What the fuck was I thinking of?
I interviewed, you know, I interviewed Freeway Rick. You know who that, the drug dealer, the ex-drug dealer? He's
no,
the guy Rick Ross took his name from.
Oh, that sounds like a 70s black guy nickname.
It is. He did 20 years. Yeah, he did, and he was a big dealer in the 80s. He was like with the Iran-Contra scandal. Like he was buying, the guy he was getting his drugs from was funneling money to the Contras. And then, you know, Rick went to jail for – he got life without parole. But he's out now on a technicality because they – it was like a three strikes thing or whatever, but they charged him twice.
So who
same thing.
Optioned the rights for this fucking great movie?
Somebody's
got to own them.
No one – Michael K. Williams is playing him in something. There's a – the reporter who broke his story is being played by Jeremy Renner. And I think the reporter committed suicide because people laughed at him. The whole Iran-Contra thing and the drug connection and the CIA putting money in the black neighborhoods. We had T.I. on.
And wait a minute. They laughed at him? So he
the reporters back then, they didn't think he was right. Like, I think when he was talking about the government, the CIA, allowing drugs into these ghetto neighborhoods.
How bad did they laugh at him? He must have been getting fucking...
Yeah. Yeah, he probably expected a Pulitzer. They were like,
were
no.
They hanging him from his press undies every day from the typewriter?
Yeah.
They keep picking on me, man. I can't take it. I swear to God,
you.
There's a connection.
They're letting the drugs come in. I fucking feel it. Yeah, and then he wound up blowing his brains out by being proven right. We thought T.I. was on a week before I interviewed Rick Ross, and we were like, it sounded kind of paranoid.
Dude, those are great guests.
Well, T.I. was on Opie and Anthony, not on
whatever.
But he was talking about the drugs with the black neighbors. Like, ah, I don't know. It sounded a little bit conspiracy. And then Rick Ross said the same thing. I'm like, fuck, man. T.I. was right. Like, I've heard it from too many different sources that the CIA apologized. It was really interesting. So he was a good interview. And then I did a couple of comedians. And, you know, hopefully we'll do more.
No, dude. You got to – when's this coming out?
This Wednesday, July 23rd.
And how does I can't say what time. Like, I guess when are they going to upload it?
I don't know. I'll just Twitter it. I'm not sure. You know, it's like they. I don't know how this one works. Like, I'm used to doing promotion for stuff. Like, I know exactly what day it's on. I know exactly what time it's on.
Right.
The first episode is being released in two parts because it's you know, it's like a 45-minute interview plus 20 other minutes of content. So it's like one day and then the next day and then they can watch the whole thing.
Sounds like a great guess. And then, you know, sidekick, nobody has anybody like Bailey J. That's great. And then usually a guy like you doesn't get – you guys – you're usually the guy the way they're like, all right, you know, just tone it down. So to see a real – I can't say – I don't want to insult anybody, but like somebody my taste –
Thank you.
Actually going out, doing a monologue and that type of stuff that you're going to pick on. That's fucking awesome, man.
It felt so nice to not have to tone it down. Because in one of the episodes, I just did a bunch of Sterling stuff, which I've been doing on stage. But it's like, how long is that going to be, you know, good for?
Right.
And
he was a fun one.
Oh my God. I hope he lives forever.
I hope with my angle on it still, because my special's coming out, and I was able to turn that into some. Like, I'm hoping the point that I'm making is still relevant.
Is there anything worse than when you shoot something and it winds up, something happens in the meantime which dates the reference or the bats?
Yeah, no, but it happens because this is I think sometimes I try not to overthink that thing where, you know, if even a guy like Richard Pryor talked about the heavyweights of his time, because, you know, there's some comics that are like, you know, don't do anything, wear anything that's going to make you look fucking, you know, in 3 years. You
can be right.
Like the cutting edge fashion, like take like Sinbad. Like some of the stuff that guy wore, you know what I mean? Like some of that just in general, some of the shit from the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s was pretty out there. So some people try to go, just wear black on black, very kind of simple thing. And then don't do anything topical because it's going to date your special. And it's like, who gives a fuck?
Yeah, who cares?
Yeah. And if it's a great joke, it's a great joke. Like that prior one, I forget, he's talking about the old retired black fighter who was refereeing. And the ref, one of the fighters was beating the shit out of a white guy, and he was joking that the guy wouldn't stop. Like, oh, shit, he looks okay or whatever. And that's still funny.
Yeah.
It's still fucking funny. So I think if the joke is there, I'm trying to convince myself.
Wait, what did Pryor say? And it was a Jerry Quarry joke.
Right.
It was something about how he just loves black people beating him up. And it made me laugh so hard. And it was 40 years after he said it. It doesn't matter. Woody Allen stuff, he does references from the early 60s. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Carlin opens one of the specials, you know, the Reagan people. I don't care.
I learned who Jerry Quarry was through Richard Pryor. I didn't know who James Brown was until Eddie Murphy did the bit.
All right.
I was that fucking white, like the world I was living in. And people would be like, how the fuck did that? How did you not know who he was? And it was like, well, my parents were that fucking white. And then there was three channels, you know?
Right.
And there was no internet. And it was like, you know, I knew who the fucking Jeffersons were. I mean, that was like the only thing that was on TV, it seemed, but Good Times. But as far as stuff like that, it was really difficult for a guy like him, even when he became an icon. You know, I just saw recently he did like the Mike Douglas show. He did some shows, but I mean, I was a little kid, so I just didn't see him. So I remember laughing at the Eddie. I told Charlie this story, and he was beside himself. He was almost offended. He goes, get the fuck out of here. Fuck that. You knew who he was. Your parents knew who he was. I'm like, I didn't. I didn't know who arguably the greatest performer of the last century was.
Do you ever see James Brown and Pavarotti? They did It's a Man's World together. How awesome is that?
It was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
You tell they really liked each other. I love stuff like that, man.
Yeah. When they, like, to me, that's a mashup. Like, I don't like when they just take two songs that are the same tempo and it's supposed to blow my fucking mind.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, well, if you get two songs that are the same speed, you drop some shit out and you throw some shit in, right? Not that I could ever figure out how to do it.
No, I couldn't. There is a genius to it, but I still resent it the same. I understand hating it. Like, I respect it. It's hard to do, but fuck them. It stinks.
All right, everybody. Here's the advertising for this week. I apologize for the bad edit. I just interviewed Jim on, like, Friday or something when he was in town. And, you know, we just did it straight through without the advertising because I didn't have it yet. So now I'm in my house. It's like 7:30 Monday morning and my wife is still sleeping. So I got to read in this creepy voice. So you're going to have to fucking deal with it. All right. You just fucking deal with it. This is going to be my voice. Dollar Shave Club, everybody. The big razor companies think we're stupid. Every year they roll out some ridiculous shaving technology gimmick and expect us to flip out and shell out big bucks for it. Do you really need a razor with a vibrating handle or a roller pivot ball, back scratcher, egg timer, laser pointer, corkscrew? You get the point, okay? You don't need it, all right? We were all just shaving fine before any of that crap, and I personally definitely don't need to spend my hard-earned cash on it. If you're sick of being treated like a moron, join the hundreds of thousands of smarter people who joined the Dollar Shave DollarShaveClub.com revolution. Dollar Shave Club delivers the best blades and grooming supplies for just a few bucks a month. Their blades are better than the big shave companies for a fraction of the price. And my listeners can get started now at DollarShaveClub.com/burr. And hey, if you're already a member, you got to go check out Dr. Kavi's post-shave lotion. It's the perfect way to make peace with your face after the disruptive act of shaving. Stop getting ripped off by the big shave companies. Join DollarShaveClub.com/burr. That's DollarShaveClub.com/burr. All right, the next one, Stamps.com. Quick, convenient, and most importantly, easy to use. That's how I would describe Stamps.com. It will make your mailing and shipping an absolute breeze. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage using your computer and your printer. There's nothing to learn. That's why I like it, because I'm an idiot. Stamps.com will give you a digital scale. It automatically calculates exact postage for any letter, any package. They'll even help you choose the best class of mail to get your mail there on time for the least amount of money. Then drop your mail into any mailbox or hand it to your mailman, and that's it. You're done. You'll never have to go to the post office again. Trust me, mailing and shipping has never been easier. I use Stamps.com to send out all my posters, my T-shirts, DVDs, whatever the hell I'm selling at the end of the week. And if I can figure it out, so can you. Right now, use my last name, Burr, B-U-R-R, for this special offer, no-risk trial, plus a $110 bonus offer that includes a digital scale and up to $55 free postage. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com right now before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Burr, B-U-R-R, that's Stamps.com, enter Burr. All right, last one, here we go. LegalZoom, everyone. Most Americans don't have a will. But why is that? You don't want the court dictating what happens to your property and your minor children, do you? Of course you don't. So why procrastinate? Most people say, well, it's too expensive or it's too time-consuming, blah, 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 blah. I got an answer for you, LegalZoom.com. Too expensive? LegalZoom prices just make sense. Too time-consuming? It just takes 20 minutes. And LegalZoom can guide you through from start to finish. The service was developed by some of the best legal minds in the country, and they make it painless for you to get the legal help you need. In fact, helping people get legally protected has been their mission for the past 13 years. During the National Make-A-Will Month, get special pricings on wills and living trusts by entering Burr, B-U-R-R, in the referral box at checkout. Again, that discount code is Burr, B-U-R-R. God forbid something happens to you, but do you really want to add to the pain as they're dragging the swing set out of the backyard and giving it to somebody else down the street, some banker's kid? Right? I know, that was a weird example, but somewhere in there that made sense. Anyways, it's National Make-A-Will Month, so don't wait. Protect your family, protect your future at LegalZoom.com today. LegalZoom was developed by top attorneys to provide self-help services at your specific direction, but they are not a law firm. Legal help is furnished through vetted independent attorneys. LegalZoom.com, discount code Burr, B-U-R-R.
Did you ever try an instrument when you were growing up?
No, I didn't. I'm not musical at all. I used to draw. I wanted to be an artist. I would draw like – I was obsessed with Kiss, so I would draw pictures of Kiss. Right. I could never draw hands. That's always the thing. My hands were terrible. So every character –
Don't you just do the three-finger thing?
No, I put the hands behind the back. I really would. Everyone had hands behind the back. I could not grasp. That's what makes an artist. If you can draw hands, you could probably draw anything in the world. Hands are an impossibility.
Really?
Try drawing someone's hand. It's fucking hard.
I think the face is hard.
Yeah, it can be, but I could work out a face. It would be a little off, you know what I mean? Like it was like Rocky Dennis-ish sometimes, but at least it was a face.
A little Bell palsy.
Yeah.
It was all right. Yeah. I always, when I tried drawing, I just remember was everybody was always jacked. Whoever I drew, like the one body type I could draw would be like fucking jacked, and everybody had the same goddamn nose, but I don't know. There's actually a show out here that I'm doing coming up. Where there's a live band, and it's, you know, I want to do the show. It's fucking cool where it's like you go out and you just sort of riff about music and that type of thing. And then when you're done with your set, you then go and jam with the band, however you want to do it. You can sing a song and they'll learn the song beforehand or whatever instrument you play.
Is that your idea or someone's?
No. This is somebody else's idea. I hope I didn't say that and everybody's going to steal the idea, but it's fucking I'm going to be doing it coming up, man. It's going to be fun as shit, though.
Wow, you have balls to do that. That would scare me.
Yeah, but what I've learned is
I don't mean yeah, like I got balls. What I've learned is that there comes a point when you get something down. Anywhere in life, you got your gig down. If you don't keep learning, you don't keep pushing yourself to try to be like, all right, whatever I'm doing, how do I get better at this? I always equate it to, like, I don't know, basketball for some reason, even though I don't fucking play it. But, like, you know, he always goes to his right. Then you got to learn to go to your left. He sucks on defense. I got to get better at defense. It's like a whole thing. Like, I read this whole – they had this great magazine out about Jordan, how he just kept working and working and working and working and working. And, like, you can literally read the article and not be a Jordan, but just apply that.
Right.
And work and work and work and work. So for me, I'm really comfortable being a stand-up, but I'm not comfortable playing drums necessarily out in public or whatever. So over the years, when every time I get a chance to sit in, I would sit in and just go through, you know, it's just like you go back to being an open micer. I think there's like an ego thing that's involved, that once you're good at something and people know you're good, you're embarrassed to kind of stink at something a little
right,
bit.
Sure.
So you're like, oh, I don't want to do that. It takes, like, I don't know. It's a balance of the balls to try it and then also still be fucking around to be like, listen, guys, I know I'm not a professional drummer or whatever. So
we can handle bombing on something like that, because as comics, you kind of learn, all right, like, I know how to be funny if I'm sucking at something, or I know how to own it.
Right.
Like, if you own something so completely, people kind of like, all right, well, what are you going to?
Right.
You know, he's owning that he's not a good drummer or singer. So
yeah, if you go out there and you're acting like a fucking idiot and you're having a good time, then they don't have to worry. Like I just don't want the crowd at any moment to have that thing like, oh wait, is he like serious here? Does he like feel like he should be in a band? I don't. Okay, for anybody concerned. I do not.
You're a good actor, though, man. You're a really good actor. I finally went through Breaking Bad, and we had interviewed everyone on that show, and I'd never seen it. Mm-hmm. We had Cranston. We had fucking the guy who played Hank. We had the Skyler, everyone. And then I finally watched it, and you're so good. You didn't take me out of it. Like, and I know you so well. And whenever you see, like, a close friend in something, and, man, I was like, fuck, that's Bill. And then right into the character. It was really fucking good, though.
Oh, thank you.
I didn't think I'd seen you since I finally watched Breaking Bad.
I'm learning to take compliments, but I will say that show, the way it was done, all you had to do is memorize what they say and hit your marks, and they handled the rest, dude. They just – it was I don't know how to equate it. Pick a great fucking sports team, and you're coming off the bench. It's like somehow you're going to end up wearing a ring, you know?
Right, yeah.
You'd be one of those guys, that awful white guy dancing that Shaq used to make fun of whenever the Lakers would win it. Like, that's who I was – who I was on Breaking Bad, but it was fun and you know.
What scene are you most nervous doing? Were you, because I remember the first time I saw you with Cranston, were you in a car?
The first time I had a scene with him, I was so excited because, dude, I was a fan of that show from the very beginning.
Oh, okay.
From the pilot episode. So I was so invested in the show and couldn't wait for the next season. So to all of a sudden be on it, interacting with these fucking characters,
it was
like you got sucked into your TV and then fast forwarded into time.
Right.
So there was this. I always said I felt like I won a radio contest or something. Like, you know, do you want to play a stormtrooper in the next Star Wars and stand next to Darth Vader? I always felt that when I was there, and I would have been happy just getting one of them. And the fact that they kept bringing me back, and the fact that, you know, Vince Gilligan used so many stand-up comics. To get back to your thing, when the question – the first scene I did with Cranston was after – I'm trying not to ruin it for anybody because everybody, you know
– people might not have seen it. Right.
You know, spoiler alert. When does that run out, you know?
I know.
But we had shaken down this guy for money, and he got hurt. So we had to go talk to the lawyer, Saul Goodman. So it was me and Lavelle Crawford. He played Huell.
I didn't realize that was Lavelle Crawford. Like, I
know he was
his name.
Fucking unreal on
yes,
the
show. Yes, he was good. I didn't realize he was a comedian too. That's right.
So we had this little bit that we were doing at the top, this whole act of God thing, and then Bryan Cranston character bursts in. So our thing was we jump up and sort of make sure that he's not coming for Saul, and then Saul tells us to screw. And I was so excited that I was actually going to be in a scene with Mr. White. Because Mr. White, to me, it took everybody, I don't know how long, like 3-4 seasons for the entire country. But for diehards like myself, like, he was, you know, I've never had a guy, like a character that I followed that I was rooting for so hard, and then all of a sudden he took this fucking turn. He took this turn where I kind of felt weird about rooting for him, and then I was just started watching, going like, "Dude, what are you doing? Just turn yourself in. Just stop." Blah blah blah. And it was like literally watching like someone you loved, like you knew, like a family member, rooting him on and making excuses for him. Yeah, what's he supposed to do? The guy, he's sick. They're not giving him any fucking. He put his time in, you know, that type of shit. And then somewhere, I don't know, after how many fucking murders and just some of the shit that he started doing to Jesse, that it started to turn. And it just was unreal. To be, you know, I've lucked out. I've really lucked out where I've gotten to be a part, very small part of some pretty amazing things. Because my IMDb page is a pretty quick read. But, I got to tell you, I've always liked the shit you've done, like the stuff you did in Spider-Man. I wish I could have seen that whole fucking rant you did, even though I don't like him and he stinks, but you were really in it, and they had you in the back of that truck. You just look like this New York guy who was dropping off something, and you were fucking pissed. Now, I know you're going to shit on your acting, but I loved it.
No, but I'm going to point out this is why Bill's a good friend, and this is why I love Bill, because honestly, you had a part in what is tremendous. It's one of the culturally biggest events.
How bad would Keith be trashing us right now for rubbing each other's balls?
Justifiably so, but we're being nice. We're friends. Keith's problem is Keith doesn't know how to be nice about anything. Oh, remind me to tell you about Keith, and he came in with that fucking – he came in with a Dave Chappelle shirt. The other night from he's wearing a Chappelle at Radio City, and me and Colin are at the table, and we're like, "Oh, you fucking fat fanboy," and we just attacked him. And he sat down for 5 minutes and he goes, "I'm going to change the shirt," and he got up and he left the Comedy Cellar and he came back with a button-down shirt over it. And that's the second time in my life I've been able to chase him out.
I remember one time he ran out. I was there that night. I forget what. He ran out.
That puffy white, awful. It looked like a bedding shirt that he had on, and I beat him so terribly.
He hung in there for like two rounds, three rounds, and then he stood up and ran out. And I remember being pissed, being like, "You can fucking do that? I didn't know you could leave." Yeah. I never thought to leave. Like that pounding I took, the bus pounding, which is one of the all-time class. You guys literally did a headlining set. You did 45 minutes. On me when I was going to do
Yankees, oh,
fuck, that was it. That was it. We were both going to do it. No. Esty, whatever the fuck it was. Esty, somebody approached the Comedy Cellar, these Atlanta Brave fans, and they said...
Oh, right. Was it the Diamondbacks or no?
No, it was the Braves. Okay. And they said, you know, they were taking a bus from Manhattan up to Yankee Stadium, and they wanted to hire a comic for the bus ride up, and at the end of it, they were going to give you a World Series ticket. So we sat there going, "Oh, man, that's going to be brutal. I don't know, blah, 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 blah," all of that type of shit. And I forget what happened at the last – without me knowing, you said, "You know what? I'm not fucking doing that. That's bullshit," right? And I didn't know it, so I agreed to do it. And then we sat down and we started trashing each other. And this is what – you started it. I
vaguely remember that.
I said this to you. I made fun of your shirt, but blah, blah, blah. And I was getting you and everyone was laughing. And you know that thing at the table. You're like, "Oh, my God, I'm winning. I'm winning. I'm finally winning here." And then as they're all laughing, you just lean in. You go, "Whatever, bus boy." And the whole table stopped and went, "What?" And you said, – "Bill Burr's going to do stand-up on a bus on the way to the..." And all fucking chairs turned at me. That's the funny... And, dude, all the killers were there. You, Patrice, Voss, Kevin Hart. There, yeah. Kevin Hart was there. Keith was there. 45 minutes. I didn't say a word and just got pounded. And I was still going to do the gig. Because, to me, that was an easy gig.
Sure.
All I had to do was shit on the Yankees the whole way, make fun of fucking New York, and say that Atlanta was better, say that I was a Red Sox fan. I would have been fucking shotgunning beers with them. It would have been a joke. But I ended up not doing the gig, which a lot of people don't know. I didn't do the gig because Patrice, in the end of it... Dude, you guys were trashing me so bad, like strangers were either laughing or they were going, "Oh..." I'm trying to think of some of the great ones. Patrice imitating me. Oh, Patrice goes, "Hey, when they call you out on stage," he goes, "are you going to come out of the bathroom or are you going to walk up those little steps?" I remember all of them. He had another one. where he was imitating me at the end of the show. And this is a visual, so I'll have to explain it. I finish. I'm in the front of the bus. And I go, hey, thanks a lot. You guys are great. And then he imitates me turning around, sitting down. And then as people are walking by, reaching over my show, good show. I'm going, hey, thanks a lot. Reaching over my shoulder. You guys asked if I was going to use the bus driver's microphone to do the show, if I was going to bring my own. Dude, every joke was just funnier than the next one, and it was never ending. I took this fucking brutal pounding, but I was still going to do it. I was like, fuck these guys. I'm a sports fan. I want to go to the game. I don't give a fuck. So in the end, you guys had all left, and it was just me and Patrice sitting there, and he just goes, Bill, he goes, you're making enough money at this point. If you want to go to the game, buy a fucking ticket, all right? He goes, dude, I will – he called me the N-word. He said, N-word? He goes, I will stand in front of that bus so you don't do that gig. Do not do that fucking gig. And it was the first time I ever thought of, like, you know, like self-esteem.
Yeah.
Like, why not just blow the cash and actually have a little dignity? Because you just come into this business doing, like, those Jersey Turnpike gigs and all that shit that you don't – you just feel like, I need to learn how to do this. So I didn't do the gig. And I actually passed the gig off to somebody else. And I had taken such a bad pounding. I said, listen, I'll never tell anybody who I gave this gig to. And I think the person who did it, didn't they come in and say who it was?
I believe they
did. I'll tell you
did.
When we're done. Because, I mean, it doesn't matter now.
Oh, no, it's funny.
It doesn't matter now. But I don't think he would care.
No.
I passed it on.
Not at all. No, we would feel bad. That's a many, many years ago. And he'd probably love to be associated.
I asked him what it was like, and he told me later. I go, what was it like? He goes, oh, dude. He goes, it was brutal.
Yeah.
It was brutal. He goes, but the second it was over and I had that World Series ticket, dude, he ran away from those people. And it's hilarious. It was their ticket, so then you just sort of sat next to them, so he kind of couldn't leave them. But I'll never forget that. That was another turning point that I learned from someone who I started with, was to have self-esteem. Like, at some point, you can't say no. Like, I'm not, you know what? I'm making enough money here in the city. I was making great money, but I was making enough money that if I wanted to blow, I mean, how much was a World Series ticket? $400-500
yeah,
back then?
Bucks,
just,
yeah,
to sit in the upper deck, to not stand on a bus, you fucking moron, and humiliate yourself. So.
You know what those gigs teach you too, like the seller, is getting pounded so terribly. Like, I get beaten so badly sometimes. Like, you know, Bobby or Keith and Colin. And, you know, when they're all attacking you, there's times where I'm a comedian for over 20 years and I find myself still answering seriously. Like, when they're killing me, I'm like, well, no, that's not exactly what happened. Like, I'm getting beaten up so bad and I know I'm helpless. I'm turning into, like, my girlfriend when I'm annoyed. Like, you know, that's not accurate at all. It's so – it's cleansing, though, to get a beating like that. It's like there's a
you know, one of my favorite ones watching you taking a beating was that time when you were on the date and Patrice was yelling over at you and you weren't talking back to him.
Oh, my
God. And he started – and you had just started opening for Dice.
That's
and you were thrilled, your hero, and you guys were hanging out. And Patrice started imitating Dice talking to you in the character during the day. And you were sitting in the corner trying to ignore him. And Patrice was all the way across the restaurant and he's going – hey, Jim, let's go to the mall. Oh! And we were all fucking crying, laughing. And you finally had to give into it, man. Like, those are the things, what I loved about it. And, like, I love watching your date kind of keep hearing the name Jim and hearing us laughing and slowly figuring out, like, is he talking about you and you trying to stay in the date for an excruciating 5 minutes, dude? Fuck, I miss that guy, man.
I remember one time I was I would always come in off the road and not sleep. I would be done with usually Dice on Saturday night. So Sunday morning I'd fly home with no sleep. And I wasn't doing radio at that time. So Sunday nights I'd be loopy and go on at the Cellar on no sleep. And I always had good sets because I'd be creative because I'd be overtired. And I would come in. We played chess every night there. I would play with Keith.
I remember. You were good, too, man.
In our little circle, yeah. But, I mean, compared to a real chess player, I'm a chimp. But, I mean, you know, in our little, the me, you, Bobby.
Yeah, but you were, like, reading the Bobby Fischer book. You were into it, dude.
Yeah, I do enjoy him.
quite a character.
I remember, because Keith was such a shit talker. Like, he's like one of those fucking bums in the park. Like, they're like master level players because they're all homeless and they play for drinks and they play for food. So they're real players. But Keith, you know, you'd move your queen.
He'd do that stupid thing with his fingers, yeah, like he was sprinkling salt.
Like he's sprinkling salt. He'd pick her up. Ah, let's see what color panties she get on. And I would, like, literally be non-comedian guy. Quit touching my fucking piece, man. And
you gotta re-explain that to the listeners. Keith, what Keith Robinson would do when he knew he was closing in on your queen, he would reach over and pick it up and be like, "Ah, what color panties is she wearing?" And set it down. Like, he was just
touching your
talking
pieces.
Oh yeah, it was annoying as shit.
And I remember one time Patrice pulled my chair out after I had lost. I had lost, and I was so fucking overtired and cranky. And he wanted to play Keith, so he had winners. And I lost, and it was just such a dismissive pull my chair out and move me. And
with you still sitting in it?
I was. Of course I was. Oh. Yeah. And he just dragged me out, and I was so mad. I went, "Don't touch my chair!" Like, I'm fucking a grown man, and that's my comeback. "Don't touch my chair!" Like, oh.
And how long did you get pounded for that?
It was just an awful night. I mean, that was a bad night. I was overtired, and I sucked. And yeah, that was
brutal. You know what was the worst was the carryover. The carryover trashing, where there was so much meat left over on the bone, yeah. You'd come back the next night and, "Hey, the fucking chair guy, sit down, dude, don't touch his chair." You're like, oh, sometimes I think about those days and I was just like, it's fucking hilarious and it's a goddamn tragedy that we never sat down and wrote anything. We took all of our comedic skills and just used them to humiliate each other.
Yeah.
We just sat there. But it all worked out, didn't it?
Those moments made every one of us a better comic, a thicker skin comic, because then you're on stage in front of 10,000 people and getting an unfair booing. That was when we first started on K-Rock.
Right.
And you had been not – the XM listeners loved you, but the K-Rock listeners didn't know you as well at that point because it was a new thing and you had been away. And they're booing you and you pull out this fucking – one of the great – moments of stand-up that I've ever witnessed, which was just turning 10,000 Philadelphia fucking monsters. And they're the worst crowds in the world if they don't like you. And you turned them. You did the impossible. And that's like
– Well, that's I lucked out the sports thing. There was enough Jersey and New York sports fans. You know, the Patrick Division and whatever, the ML – the National League East, yeah, or whatever. There's enough Mets fans that hated the Phillies. There's enough fucking – fans, everybody hates the fucking Flyers, you know, except for Philly fans. So I was able to do that. But what was funny was I actually, when I finished that set, I felt bad because you had to go on next. And I was like, oh, God, you know, when a comic burns down, yeah, the room. And that was basically, that was not a, like, you can burn down the room, I feel, as the headliner. But to burn down the room when there's another guy going up on basically your showcase night, I was sitting there. I thought you were going to be mad at me. And
not
I was, and you went out, never addressed what just happened, went right into your act and fucking smashed them.
Yeah, I mean, again, they knew me, though. It was like the terrestrial crowd knew me, so I had to, you know, it was kind of like, you know, they were expecting me to come out. But I felt, you know, if that show had occurred 6 months after that,
right,
when that crowd knew you, that never would have happened. That was a really weird transition time. But what you did with that crowd, I mean, yeah, it was the sports knowledge, but it was about the ability to pull that out in front of all those people, because it took a while. They didn't just start laughing.
Well, you know what? I had been booed before. I got booed on a Vegas show. And I didn't leave, but I didn't know. The first time you get booed, dude, is fucking unreal. It's like, it's the weirdest experience because you have exactly what you want, the total focus of the crowd, but the exact opposite emotion.
Right.
I've always compared it to, like, you know, when they do the reverse echoes on those Zeppelin things to make it seem like you're in hell, like the echo comes first before your voice. That's like sort of the stand-up version of that, where it's like they're cheering but they're booing. It's the most fucked up thing. And I remember after getting booed, just fucking walking through the hotel, going back to my room, and I started thinking about people in the crowd. And it's like, all right, Bill, you got booed, but you let that guy boo you? You let that woman with that awful dress, that guy with the big head? You could have at least said that. It was just so shocking the first time it happened. And also, I did a lot of those, the uptown rooms, as they called them, the black rooms.
Oh, black crowds,
yeah. So you kind of had to get, you know, I was in fighting shape. So it somehow, I just remember Opie coming through the curtain. Opie and Ant, I think he had his glass of red wine, and Opie just came walking through and was just like, he said, he goes, "That was one for the ages, bro." And yeah, just came walking out. And what was funny was you went out and killed, and the second that was done, that was the end of the show. And then they brought me back out for the curtain call, and I got booed again, half clapping, half booing. And I remember there was this dude who ran up to the stage. He was going, Bill Burr. He's screaming. He's going, fuck you. Fuck you. And I'm going, what? And he's giving me the finger. He's going, fuck you. Fuck you. And I kept going, what? It's like, you're giving me the finger. How do I not know? I just kept going. I can't hear. I literally got him hopping mad. He was jumping up and down, screaming, giving me the finger. I just kept going. I can't. And I kept cupping my ear like, I can't hear you. And the guy went, fuck you. Fuck you. And it just, I just laughed at him. And that was the end of it. And I remember I rode back with Bobby Kelly. And I had a fucking splitting headache after it. And I just remember riding back with Bobby. And he was just laughing. Going, dude, do you realize you just told 10,000 people to go fuck themselves? And I was dreading it because I was like, fuck, I know somebody filmed that. Because I thought when it got on the internet, I knew comics would appreciate it. But I didn't know that – I didn't know if fans would get it. If they would just be like, oh, you got booed. You sucked. You know, fuck this guy. Ha ha. Everybody laughing at you and shit. Because, you know, can kind of go either way. But whatever. I we're here for you here.
No. That to me was that was a fascinating thing to watch because it was legitimately funny stuff. It wasn't like you were obnoxious and got the crowd. Like, you were really pounding them like a comic. Like, that's what was so fun about it. If you had just taken your pants off and waved your cock at them, and like, all right, any idiot could.
Well,
you,
still fucking hilarious, though.
But that would have been much better, obviously. But, I mean, that was still – that would have been, like, instant legend. But the fact that you got them as a comic.
I saw a guy do that.
Did you?
I'm not going to say because I don't want to get him in trouble. Sure. But I saw when I was doing late nights at the Cellar. Do you remember how they used to have that water pipe that used to hang?
Sure.
And this guy used to go up. He's a fucking madman. And he used to fucking hang from that pipe by one arm. And he had this crazy look on his face. He looked like Charles Manson. I'm trying to let you know who this guy was, right? So he went on stage and he's doing his fucking thing. And like really just one of these great comics where like just – the pain of whatever he went through is right there on the surface. So if anybody moves, he's going to cut their head off. So there was some woman who was all fucking dressed up or something sitting, you know, she's in her 50s and she's not laughing. And he just keeps looking at her and he just finally just starts going like, isn't that right, mom? Huh? Mom, mommy. And he got in her face and he finally just goes, mom, and screamed in her face. And she got like mad. And she goes, she started giving him shit. And he said, like, lady, if you don't, he got to the point. He's like, lady, if you don't shut up, I'm going to take my dick out and slap you in the face with it. And she goes, you don't have the balls. And he goes, oh, I don't have the balls. And he starts unzipping his pants. The crowd is going fucking nuts because they think he's joking. And he fucking pulled his dick out. Pulled his dick out. And he had it by the shaft, and just his fucking purple head is coming out. And he made these machine gun noises and went, dick, 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 like right in her face, dude. Fucking place went ballistic. Fucking ballistic. And he ended his set there.
I hope so, yeah.
And Wanda, who was hosting at the time, up and coming, Wanda Sykes, I think she was the host, fucking outroed him and then brought me up. Was it Wanda? Wanda hosted one of the fucked up ones. I can't remember. So brings me up, and I had to go on after him, and I was still new to New York, and I was already going to bomb. And he took his dick out and shook it in this fucking woman's face. And, dude, I can't even tell you how hard I ate it. And I was too green. I didn't know to be like, just riff about the guy
taking his dick.
Dude,
was.
I went up and tried to do my act. I went up and I immediately went up and like, gee, it's been raining a lot here in New York City. It just completely flatlined.
Yeah,
so.
It's like walking into a party and not acknowledging what's just been happening. Yeah.
It was awful.
Yeah, I think I know who you mean, man.
Yeah, there you go. Well, listen, we're a little over an hour here, dude. I can't tell you how excited I am.
Thank you, Bill.
To see it. And once again, promoted, it's going to be this Wednesday.
July 23rd is the premiere episode with Dana White and Mike Tyson are my guests. And I think people will like it. I'm actually really happy with it, which is rare.
Dude, I'm as excited to see the monologue as I am just to see a guy like you. Because I always wondered. I always wondered, like, you know, you ever be like doing a bit and you're just thinking, that'd be a great monologue joke because it's topical. Like, say your Clippers guy stuff. You know, which I haven't seen, which I know is going to be fucking great. But, like, I can't imagine, like, seeing that kind of thing rather than just being, like, the safe
right.
sort of – looks like there's going to be two empty seats courtside come tonight and the Clippers.
Right.
I mean, some of the monologues, it's like, dude, are you even fucking trying?
Anyways, that's the special podcast here with Jim Norton. Dude, I'm glad I finally able to get you on this.
I appreciate
it,
man.
I'll see you up in Montreal. Oh. I'm going to try to drag my hungover ass out of bed and come down and do the now Opie and Jimmy show.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I'm doing the keynote speech, too. So it should be a real gentleman's affair. And
you are.
I know you're getting the award this year for Comic of the Year.
For hanging in there long enough to get one.
You deserve it, man. You've had a great year, and it's a deserved thing. If I see a comic where I don't like getting shit like that, I'm not just saying that because you're my friend. You're a great comic. And when you see a guy you admire, you know, it's like the thing is people are like, I don't suck each other's dicks. But it's like I don't get to tell my friends – like, you know what I mean? Like, hey, man, I love what you – like, you don't get to tell your friends that. We're used to each other.
All right.
You know,
it's like I just like sometimes. Doing festivals because I finally get to see you guys because once we all start – we all moved up the same time.
Yeah.
You know, hosting, featuring, and then headlining. So you never got to work on the road with each other. But when we were all doing spots in the city, you could kind of watch. That was another thing. Remember we used to go downstairs when someone would be on stage and you just stare at them?
Kevin Hart.
Yeah, and try to take the confidence. And Kevin didn't back down.
Nope, he took it.
And he was very new too.
We would walk down, me, you, Patrice, Keith, Bobby, whoever else was around, just sit in the – because the cellar was half empty back then – and sit in the front rows, or laugh obnoxiously loud at his awful jokes. Ugh. When he was – you know, I'm a little – you know, his little fucking short guy.
What about
jokes.
When Florentine would start groans?
Oh, my God.
Those are the greatest skills I've ever – he would sit in the back – he would sit in the back of the crowd, and he would turn the crowd on you by, like, groaning. He could almost, like, throw his voice Jesus.
Oh, come on.
Oh, yeah, come on. And then, like, it was contagious. And then there'd be, like, three people. Ah. Oh, and he would just get it going.
We ruined Voss's night one night at Caroline's because the curtain was drawn. It was a Sunday night. Jim's on one side of the curtain, and I'm on the other. And just doing the – it was, like, groans in stereo. Like, oh, man. And it was Florentine's the one that conceptualized that. And I'll never forget Voss for 45 minutes on stage just being combative – with you, like, what the fuck do you guys want from me? You know how, like, fucking ornery he is, fucking dope. So, yeah. Florentine's...
Why did we do that to each other?
It's fun.
Why didn't we support you? We never support each other. I remember Voss and Patrice got into some huge fight down in Caroline's because he was actually opening for Patrice. And Patrice trashed his CD so bad, he brought it up on stage and he ripped it in half, and like, ripped the cover in half and then broke it. And he was trashing it so bad, and the crowd laughed so hard that Voss got mad for real. And it was one of the, you know, we've had a zillion real arguments, and then 2 days later, you don't give a fuck. And it was just like, why would you do that?
Me and Patrice had a real argument when we were doing the Colin Quinn show on NBC. I was trying to get something through standards and practices. Uh-huh. And, you know, he was just being Patrice. Rah, rah. He just giving me a hard time with this woman. And I'm like, fucking dude, shut up. Like, you know, and I'm like, you know, I know you're a comedian. You don't have to prove it. I'm fucking doing it. This is work. You know, I was trying to get, like, literally a piece of material through. And we had, like, a real argument over it. And Keith had to fucking play, you know, the arbiter.
Yeah, yeah. I had a real fucking – I had a one that became a classic because of the fucking internet. I had that huge one with him over the stupid fucking Man Cow show on your show, on the Opie and Anthony show. We, like – Patrice called up, told his Man Cow thing, trashed me, and then I called up Monday to defend myself. And, of course, somebody on the show put fucking Patrice on hold. He just put the two dogs in the ring, you know.
I vaguely remember. I don't even know if
– dude, it was a fucking – like, we were pissed at each other for, like – you know what? It was funny. What broke the ice, I think, was that Philly rant. The Philly rant, we finally started talking to each other. We hadn't talked in, like, you know, 3-4 months, which wasn't hard because we weren't seeing each other too much, but we were kind of just pissed. And if you watch the Philly rant, there's a time where I look over the DJ going, dude, why are you yelling out shit? You're fucking me up. I vaguely remember doing that, but what it actually was Patrice was trying to help me. He yelled out Invincible, which would have been a great one to bring up about Philly, which was about a guy who was playing it, was working in a bar. Tries out for the Eagles. Not only does he get a tryout, he makes the fucking team and has an impact. Like, I could have just gone off on how bad the Eagles sucked. He threw that out there. Like, got past our stupid acting like a couple bitches not talking to each other, saw me in trouble and fucking threw that out there. And then when I came off stage, he just started talking, like, you know, one of the few times he ever threw me a compliment.
Right.
And then, you know, then we were cool after that. It was just like a fucking, I don't know.
Ah, Jesus Christ. Whatever. We got a lot of stories at this point. You
yeah.
know?
It's nice, though. I like it, though. I like, you know, like musicians. I hear musicians talk. And I'm like, that must have been fun to be a part of that. But then I realized, like, hey, I'm a part of a pretty cool group of people, just comedians who I like. And it's like, I never get to watch. I don't watch Dave Attell. I don't watch you if you're on. I don't want to watch stand-ups. Like,
did you
I
see Attell's latest special?
Can't do it.
Did
no.
you see it? Oh, my God. Was
I
it great?
I won't watch it. I love oh. Dave. We were doing co-headlining gigs. And he would walk on stage literally like a fucking – like a gnome. He's carrying a plastic bag with things in them. It's like he's losing his mind. And every once in a while, because I would always make him go on last. And I'm like, look, dude, I'll take less money. I don't need
50. That's the antisocial.
No. This was just me and Dave doing double gigs together.
Okay.
And
Jesus, what a fucking show.
It was a good show. But then we would riff at the end. Like I would come on stage with him and we would just do like 15 or 20 minutes playing with the audience. And that was fun. That was
you were awesome part. At that. Yeah.
We had a good time. And he's great. But watching him, like, even for the couple of minutes when I came back, he would always throw out one or two that would just make me fucking hate being a comedian. Like, God, I'll never – he just did one dumb line. Like, you ever been on mushrooms or you're so high and you think you're having a pillow fight, but then you realize you're holding a live baby? I'm like, I just wish I thought of that. That's
dude,
just...
he had one, and I don't remember how we set it up, but the Olympics were going on, and somebody doing the luge had died that day, and he went on stage and said something to the effect that I think it's very fitting that the Olympics started with the sacrifice. I can't even do how he did it, but he did it. You know when he talks like low, yeah. And he just sort of vaguely threw it out there, and. Just to see if the crowd even got it. And I was just like, oh, my God, that's so fucking – it was such a smart joke going back to the original Olympics and, like, that time. I don't know. They had – I don't even fucking know. It's just – yeah, he's one of those – but he's a guy that I will watch because there's – him and Harlan Williams are two guys. The way they do their shit, it's just like there's no way I'm going to – right. There's going to be no overlap the way – like Harlan, when he just comes up, hey, what do you say there, pig in a blanket? What are you doing there, buddy? Huh?
Right.
What are you doing there, sport? And he just kind of goes off on these crazy – I don't even know what he's doing. Absolutely fucking destroys. That last time I worked with Harlan, I said that to him. I go, nobody in your career has ever walked up to you going, hey, Harlan, I kind of have a – kind of got a joke like that, you know? So anyways, I got my dog downstairs.
Okay,
I gotta go
thank
go,
you for coming.
Get her. Yeah, man. You're so funny. You're so used to doing the fucking show. You said thank you for coming. Oh, actually, I did come over to your hotel room.
You did, yeah,
I thought
yeah,
it was
yeah.
like, okay, well.
I appreciate it.
Dude, thank you for coming on the podcast. I'm glad we were able to finally knock one of these out. And yeah. Like you said, Wednesday, July 23rd, what's the website?
Vice.com. It'll be easy to find.
Vice.com. Check out Jim Norton's new show called?
The Jim Norton Show.
The Jim Norton. Oh, Jesus, that's clever.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, go fuck yourselves. I'll see you on Monday.